Hello, this is Rowan Cook speaking, and welcome to the first episode of Pop Philosophy. I'm one of two hosts, Rowan Cook, and this here is...
Jock Gray, hello.
And this is the first episode of our podcast, Pop Philosophy, on New Year's Day. How wonderful is that?
Perfect way to kick off the new year, Rowan.
Yeah, kick off the new year. So we're going to give you guys a bit of a rundown of what our podcast is going to be about. Basically, we're going to be looking at movies, anything in pop culture, music, artists, nerd culture, anything in that spectrum of things. And we're just going to sit down and we're going to dissect the shit out of it.
Tear it apart to look at the insides. Yeah.
Look at it. Poke around inside of its head. Absolutely rip it apart. Destroy it if we have to.
Finding the face of God.
So since this is the first episode, we have no sponsors or anything. But we're just going to introduce ourselves for a bit. So I'm Rowan Cook. I've had a podcast in the past called Cyber Babble. And this is my second... Hopefully my second proper podcast that I can actually get out. And what about yourself, Jock? Why are you here? Why are you in the studio today?
I'm here to talk about the things that interest me the most, which is very broad philosophical concepts, which often lead nowhere. But
so why do you like philosophy for a start?
I can't really put a finger on it. I just like stretching my mind beyond sort of the everyday kind of, I guess, drudgery of sort of thought.
Yeah, I've become really fascinated. I think for me, I've always been criticised by people for dissecting films too much. Like, I look way beyond.
Yeah, I've gotten that a lot too. you know, if I ever watch a movie with my parents, you know, every time my mum's just like, damn it, Jock, just shut up.
Just shut up. Just watch the film. There's not too much depth.
You're not supposed to think about this. And I go, no, you are supposed to think about this.
Well, you are. And I think it's important to actually look at, well, especially if we find a good movie, I think it's important to actually break it down, look at the motifs. What were, you know, the people thinking of? Yeah. Was it a historical context? Was it a philosophical context? Was it a spiritual context?
Well, that's the best thing, I think, about film as a medium is its ability through visual and audio stimuli to get you to think about the world and tell a story and really see the world in a different light. And if you're, you know, if you're watching a movie, you're not thinking about it, then you're kind of defeating the purpose. I know. I mean, some movies, they're just, you know, sometimes you just want to watch a movie for entertainment. You know, you just want to switch
off. Well, you know, definitely, like, I don't think, like, The Nutty Professor, you could go too far into a movie like that. Oh, you could, because it's got the whole entire Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sort of motif. But I think apart from that, like, the film doesn't actually go too far. But we probably might even review that later on if we decide to do more than three episodes.
Right. So... I think you could be right, though. There is definitely a point where if you know, you stare too long into the abyss, then the abyss stares back.
Have you ever come across a movie that you think you've actually thought way too much about?
A movie that I've thought way too much about? Well, probably since meeting you, Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, I think what actually brought us to do this podcast was because I was talking about The Last Jedi. No spoilers. Because we're not here to talk about Last Jedi today. We both need to sit down and watch that movie. But I think Star Wars for me is one of the... Some people it's like The Matrix that bring them into the world of philosophy. Yep. But I think for me it's really... Actually the prequel trilogy of Star Wars with the underlining overtones of like...
Yeah. Rowan is a firm believer that the prequels were the hidden gems of the Star Wars
universe. I wouldn't say that, but... To just kind of, well, I study international relations and there's definitely like some of the issues in the UN, I could definitely draw a comparison to what's going on in the Star Wars prequels. I don't know how intentional that was by George Lucas, but they're definitely there.
Well, just constant talks and negotiations that go absolutely
nowhere. Well, that's interesting because if you actually look at the prequels...
A lot of very blank, expressionless faces.
Well, like, they should just rename the whole entire prequel, you know, trilogy, like, the United Nations, you know, the quest for more funding, you know. So do you have a favorite philosopher?
Yes, I do. Nietzsche.
Nietzsche. So yep. What's he? Okay, I better also state that you're probably a bit more into the philosophy realm than I am. I play around with philosophy like a bogan plays around with a rusty car, but you're a bit more into it.
Actually, no. It's not Nietzsche. Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, what was his shtick?
So he was a 1920s French existentialist philosopher.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of his philosophy, his dialogue, was about what it means to be free,
mm-hmm.
and also what it means to be yourself.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
He was very focused on identity,
mm-hmm.
And also how a person's identity operates within the constraints of reality, basically.
Okay, so you could
He wrote several kind of very well-known books. One was Nausea,
mm-hmm.
And it was basically just a book about a guy sitting on a train and mm-hmm. Basically just doubting everything he knows about reality, and mm-hmm. he comes to all these completely nonsensical conclusions that basically life is absurd. He looks at a chair and thinks, well, what is really a chair?
Yeah. That's like the epistemology together, yeah. side of things, isn't it? Like, what is a chair? What is its final property?
Yeah. So it kind of leads into epistemology.
Mm, yeah, okay.
So the thing is with philosophy, it's really difficult to draw lines between all the different mm. Kind of fields, because often what starts out as an existentialist discussion becomes epistemological when you're arguing over, you know, meanings and terms mm. because they're all relative.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about my favourite philosopher. So I've always liked Aristotle, you know, for a basic, simple premise, right?
Who doesn't like Aristotle?
But just for his, like, how to win an argument sort of thing. What is it with the... there's three, like, tiers where you can win an argument. You got to look at the emotion, you got to look at the intent, and you got to look at, like, the actual logical, you know, explanation of how they actually got there. And once you have those three things, you can go into any bedroom anywhere in the world and win an argument.
Yep.
And just for that alone, that's why Aristotle kind of wins it hands down. There's some other things there, like he wasn't into atoms and all that, so I'm aware of that. So he wasn't the smartest philosopher out of all of them. Well, for his time, he probably was. But
Aristotle and I think the ancient Greek philosophers in general, you know, there's a reason everyone who studies philosophy always starts with the ancient Greek philosophers and works up from there because, you know, they really put the nail on the head with a lot of the basics of philosophy and rhetoric, especially. Just how to compose an argument, you know, the sort of how to follow a logical train of thought to come to a conclusion, all that was really set up in the kind of Athenian schools of logic.
I think Aristotle was a bit of a cheap one for me.
Yeah.
But I'd definitely have to go another cheap one for me. Karl Marx.
Karl Marx.
You know, just because he was so indecisive, you know.
I mean, like, I still don't know whether Karl Marx, whether you can really call him a philosopher.
He was definitely a thinker.
I think he philosophized a lot. He was a thinker, but he was much more of, I think, a political scientist and an economist than a philosopher. Like, he applied philosophical concepts into his studies.
To his thing. I think he's still... But then do you have an opinion on Ayn Rand?
Ayn Rand? Yeah. She was completely unhinged. I think she had some very challenging ideas, and some of them weren't so far off the mark. But, you know, I think she's also one of those people who are taken way out of context and kind of used to justify outlooks on life that she really shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly in the neoliberal school of thought. She's kind of like the, you know, second coming of Jesus for some of those people.
Yeah. So we've got your favourite philosophers out of the way. But do you have any favourite movies that you could apply to philosophy? Do you have a movie in mind that really makes you excited about philosophy, that makes you think?
Well, the movie we're discussing today, of course, Donnie Darko.
Donnie Darko, yeah. But is there one personally that you really, really like?
I know I do have one, but it's not coming to mind right now.
Not coming to
mind.
Don't have to write it down. Can you remember any images or any actors? Anything like that?
Drive.
Yeah, okay.
And I think Nicholas Winding Refn's movies in general. They kind of make me feel like...
It's so funny. Like, I was thinking about Drive because we had a discussion before we started recording. And I don't really picture Drive as a philosophical... it's one of those films that I think is really about the aesthetics, you know, the style and the aesthetics of the movie.
There's really not much to the story. And it's not very complex, but that's kind of what I like about it, is you can just look into it and sort of... create what you want out of it. And there's that very visual storytelling.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those, you've got to kind of think about what you want from the movie, you know, which, you know, it's, well, there you go. It's definitely the essence of, you know, philosophy. I think I've covered off The Matrix and all that. There's also, like, for me personally, I also like Ghost in the Shell, and I think Ghost in the Shell really opened up the whole entire identity complex for me. You know, if I could download my identity onto a disc, would I still be me?
Yeah. A Blade Runner would be another big one for
you. The new Blade Runner, which I'm looking forward to reviewing that. I'm probably going to do so much research into that, you know, because even while I was watching the new Blade Runner movie, I was definitely in the cinema. And I think this was the difference between why I enjoyed that movie and why some people didn't enjoy that movie, is because the movie actually demanded my attention and it wanted me to think about it, you know. And it was a slow-paced film. And I kind of think, well, why go see that movie if you can't pay attention? You know what you're in for. The first Blade Runner was, you know, a pretty sophisticated movie for its time. I've already had some people on social media tell me that it's not, and to a degree, it is a very simplistic story, but like all things, as we've discussed before, simplicity can also come with its own set of complexity.
Yeah.
So, if that makes sense.
I mean, as far as Blade Runner goes, I don't think there was, like, the themes in general, there wasn't anything particularly original there.
It was mainly
just in the way it was presented.
Well, because it was just like a movie about a detective investigating a murder at the end of the day.
But also the higher up sort of ideas of, you know, do robots dream of electric sheep?
Philip K. Dick stuff.
Where's the line between humanity and robot? You know, that's all stuff that had been covered a lot, you know, in previous literature and movies and stuff. You know, a lot of science fiction, stuff like that. But, yeah, with Blade Runner, it was just because it put it in that beautiful cinematic landscape and really put you into that world and actually make you believe that this could happen.
Well,
and that's what we were saying before about movies being a means to actually put you into that headspace.
One thing I really liked about the new Blade Runner... I know you haven't seen it, but it did a real good, fantastic job at creating a world, and you just got sort of sucked into it. And the movie didn't say, this is how they farm. It was like, okay, work that shit out for yourself. Like, we're in a dystopian world. How else? They're going to farm maggots or something, you know, get that protein. You know? It's all down. One thing I do love about Blade Runner, and this is kind of a bit off topic, but I love the fact that Coca-Cola, Atari, and that still survived. Even though Atari went bust, but Coca-Cola. Like, I don't think I could picture a world without Coca-Cola, you know, so.
Oh, well, it's pretty obvious who's going to be running the world in,
Disney.
20 years or so. Disney.
Once they own, you know, the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yeah, we'll have the Coke versus Disney intellectual intergalactic war.
Yeah, a huge war. The mouse, you know, versus, you know, the Coke brothers.
Nuclear bombs flying everywhere with, like, the Disney and Coke kind of emblems.
Oh, that got dark. What are your opinions on Disney with the franchising of all these Marvel films?
Look, with Disney, I just think it's one of the most diabolical corporations in the world. I can kind of respect it being exactly what it is.
It's funny because my anti-capitalist thing, I don't like big corporations, but they make such damn good movies.
I mean, so. I think Disney, they make good movies. They make movies that are fun to watch and they're creative often, but I still think that Disney is going to be the company that kills creativity in the long run just by, you know, monopolizing intellectual property across the board.
Okay, we're just going to go to a quick soundbite and then we're going to start talking about our movie of the day. And we are back to talk about Donnie Darko. So let's give a brief synopsis of this lovely little fairy tale movie. So a troubled teenager is plagued by visions of a man in a large rabbit suit who manipulates him to commit a series of crimes after he narrowly escapes a bizarre accident, according to IMDb. I think that pretty much sums up the whole
IMDb.
IMDb.
Capital D, little b.
Okay. Sorry. Basically, that little summary there is... What do you think the movie is about?
Well, I don't think that summary really does it justice, probably. What is Donnie Darko about? I think... That is really difficult to answer that question.
I wonder the guy that had to sit down and write a synopsis, you know, like a brief little, you know, thing on the back. What the hell am I writing about?
You were saying this before. Mm-hmm. It's really a pretty simple story when you think about it. It's just a kind of hero story, And it follows a fairly, you know, typical progression of, you know, a guy comes in, he comes up against a conflict.
Yep.
Has a trouble and then resolves it towards the end of the story.
Yeah.
And it's about his struggle to come to terms with,
his different moral struggles. You know, so...
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
But it just has so many complex kind of themes and storylines sort of woven in there. Mm.
I suppose that's why it's become a bit of a cult classic, because it was one of those films that absolutely bombed at the box office when it first came out. It was a pretty low-budget film when it came out and it bombed at the box office. But then, because of the rise of DVDs and stuff, people started getting this movie and... There's a very sort of hypnotic thing about the movie. I don't know. It's like an 80s sort of atmosphere to it.
Yeah, very 80s atmosphere. That's one of the things I love about
and
it.
And it almost feels relaxing to watch, if you get what I mean. Like, it's not a big blockbuster. It's just with the 80s overtone, the sort of basic dialogue. It just sort of guides you into this... Lovely, I remember, little relaxing journey.
Yeah, I remember that the first time I watched it. It was almost kind of... The beginning of the movie was sort of lulling me into a bit of a false sense of security, you know, where it was just thought it was a kind of, you know, coming of age sort of 80s, you know, teenage classic sort of thing. But then, like, after the second half of the film, as it sort of builds up, it just gets more and more complex and all these sort of themes just start coming into it.
Before we actually dive into the nitty-gritty philosophy of Donnie Darko... What were your overall impressions of the film? We've just watched it before we start recording this podcast, so what were your overall impressions of Donnie Darko? Did you enjoy the film? Did you like it? Or have you got a few issues with it?
Yeah, it's perhaps, it's up there as one of my favourite films of all
really?
Time. Yeah.
Like top 10, top 20?
Yeah, easily top 10.
Easily top 10. For me, Donnie Darko was a top 10 movie. And then, like, over the years, I kind of called a bit of bullshit on the philosophy of it. I was like, actually, after rewatching it today, and I think I said this to you before we started recording, that I found it a lot more enjoyable because I actually went in with a goal of trying to figure out what the hell it was about. Like, I had, like, some breath of new life. So I think I actually enjoyed that viewing we had today a lot more than some of the other viewings of Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
Because I rewatched this film a lot when I was young because I found the character of Donnie Darko actually quite relatable.
Yeah,
I
can relate to him a lot actually.
With the whole teenage angst and, you know, people always trying to control you and stuff and you just want to flip out, you know. There's more to love than... and love and hate or whatever.
So. Yeah, you just want to get up and tell your teacher to shove her book up her proverbial.
Yeah, yeah. actually, it was pretty funny because when I first watched this movie, it was actually a teacher that gave me the DVD and he said, "Here, Rowan, you'll love this." And I did love it. First viewing, just totally got it, just loved it.
Yep.
But I think I just got Donnie Darko'd out after a while and I just said, okay, there was a bit too much thinking involved.
Yeah.
So, well, not thinking, I just got sort of bored of people looking into it after a while, but now that I've rediscovered philosophy, I've found the love in it again, so...
I don't think I, when I first watched it, I didn't actually read into it that much.
Yeah.
I would have been about 14, I think, the first time I watched Donnie Darko, and I remember it was... One of the, I liked it so much because I found it on my dad's hard disk, I think, and I had no idea what kind of movie it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those things, I just watched it out of the blue, and by the end of the movie, I was just, you know, physically shaking because there was just so much in-depth kind of, and like really emotional kind of stuff in there for me. Like,
sort of interesting. So Richard Kelly has directed some other films. None of them have really become as popular as Donnie Darko. He did one after Donnie Darko called Southland Tales, which dealt with, again, I think he's got a thing with the apocalypse and the end of the world.
Yeah.
But it's got like The Rock and I think it's got like Ally McBeal in it and it deals with like neo-Marxists and like apocalyptic stuff and The Rock has like severe anxiety and stuff. It's a really good... I wouldn't say it's a good film. I had someone actually get up me the other day because I recommended that film. And they said, "Oh, no, I can't believe you said Southland Tales was a good film." And I was like, well, I enjoyed it because it was a good think piece.
Yeah.
You know, so,
I've never seen that. What?
Yeah, if I can get – it's a bit of a – I think that itself has become a bit of a cult classic, but it hasn't got a high rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
So, like, critics hated it because it's bloody long. So, but – it's sort of interesting because you don't hear much of Richard Kelly. Like, I've seen his name plastered around in a few other productions, but I think Donnie Darko will always be his masterpiece.
Yeah.
You know, so just this thing that he was able to create.
It's going to be the thing he's always going to be known for.
Mm. As well, before I was saying, like, I think when he actually came up with the idea of Donnie Darko, I could just picture Richard Kelly, like, in like a lecture hall, like studying philosophy, just examining all the students around him and then just thinking about time travel and just trying to cram it all into one little tiny narrative. So
yeah, probably just like working it out there on the stage in front of all the students, just going on a complete tangent and all these students are going, what the hell?
All right, I think we've got a brief synopsis. Shall we go to another soundbite and then... we're going to dive into Plato's Cave and examine the shit out of this.
Plato's Cave, really?
Yeah, I know.
You're going down that road.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
It was as though this plan had been with him all his life, pondered through the seasons. Now, in his 15th year, crystallized with the pain of puberty.
So, why'd you move here?
My mom had to get a restraining order against my stepdad. He has emotional problems.
Oh, I have those too. What kind of emotional problems does your dad have?
I met a new friend.
Real or imaginary?
Your cup, Donnie.
Imaginary.
I'm going to tell you a little story today about a young man whose life was completely destroyed by these instruments of fear.
I haven't seen stuff.
Donnie is experiencing what is commonly called a daylight hallucination.
I have to obey him. He saved my life.
Have you ever seen a portal?
Has he ever told you about his friend Frank, the giant bunny rabbit?
The what?
Look, every living thing follows along set path, and... if you could see your path or channel, then you could see into the future, right?
I'm not going to be able to continue this conversation.
Don't worry. You got away with it.
What is going to happen?
I only have a few days left before they catch me.
Okay, and that was a nice little section that we listened to there. So, anyhow, what is this movie about, Jock? What do you think it's about? Oh, that's all right. We can edit that out and, you know.
In post-production.
In post-production. We can just edit anything out in post-production. Yeah. We'll do a George Lucas on the whole entire thing. Oh, I really wanted to put some Ewoks here so they could blink.
Yeah. So, really bad CGI.
Yeah, really bad CGIs and Jawas everywhere.
But anyway, yeah, so what were your thoughts, Rowan?
Okay, so knowing that we were reviewing this film, I actually did write some notes that came to my head while I remember that I came to the conclusion of. So originally going into the film, I've always thought the film had, it's always talking about this idea of free will, right? Yeah. You've got to make a choice, you know? And I think a lot of people get so confused with the movie, they only just look at the movie, but you've got to look at the whole entire narrative itself of the movie, because then when you can break that down, you actually realize that the film is a simple story, but simple stories are littered with complexities. Like you look at Lord of the Rings or something like that.
You have to pull your head out of all the time travel kind of stuff to really.
Yeah, and there's all these other little tiny mechanics going on in the background. And the other thing too, like the movie, the way it's constructed, only tells you enough, but not the whole entire story. It just lets you figure out the rest of the story. So when it goes into the time travel things, it tells you that time travel is possible. You need these things, but it doesn't tell you how to do the thing that you need to do.
Yeah.
You have to work that shit out yourself, boy. You have to go out there, sort that out yourself. So at the beginning of the movie, there's an election going on, Dukakis versus Bush. And they're talking about that at the dinner table, right?
That's interesting because Dukakis is one of those names I never remembered. I like Bush, but not Dukakis.
I wrote that down this time. So there's Dukakis versus Bush, and they're talking about the choice and the weight of choices at the dinner table.
Yep.
And that little tiny political subtext right there kind of sets a whole entire motif for the whole entire film, all about choices, you know, which one's right and which one's wrong. You know, is, you know, George Bush right or is Dukakis right? I'm not saying that the movie's like a political examination, but what the film is trying to do is sort of set the tone that choices will be made. So basically, we get throughout the whole entire film and we get to this idea where Donnie Darko is sitting in the classroom and we first meet Drew Barrymore's character, the teacher, and she's talking about a movie called The Destructors by Graham Greene. And the whole entire point of that story is all about rebirth. You have to destroy everything and everything.
Well, she says, doesn't she, the idea is destruction can be a form of creation.
Yeah,
I think Donnie actually says that.
Yeah, that's why right here. Destruction is a form of creation. So instantly, once I heard that, what popped inside my head was definitely like sort of Christianity sort of motifs and like religious motifs and stories like that, you know, like rebirth and death. And the film really does play around with that, the circular motion. It uses time travel as a way to explore Christianity or religious context in general. I'm not necessarily saying religious, but I think just because where the setting is, like Christianity would be the...
Well, since we've got on to that topic, this idea that, of all this Christian sort of symbolism interwoven into Donnie Darko is something that, you know, you and me really just started to discover, you know, with this most recent viewing.
Yeah, yeah, which I never noticed until today.
I never really noticed it until today, but there's so many scenes in there where they directly reference God, and especially with the when Donnie's talking to his therapist, and he's struggling basically with his deeply held sense of meaninglessness and lack of power in his own life, and the therapist keeps on bringing up, but what about God? Can you turn to Him?
Yeah. You bring up one interesting point during the whole entire film, like, and it was one of the first questions I wrote, like, who is Frank? And you had this interesting idea when they're in the cinema, when you said, do you think Frank could be God? And at first I was like, no, that wouldn't be a good idea. But then they actually walked out of the picture theater and, well, I can't remember what it was a Christ movie. It was a famous Jesus Christ movie.
Yeah, it was...
you know the movie?
Yeah, I know. You mentioned actually what the name was.
I didn't even write down what the Christ movie was.
Yeah, but it was you who spotted that walk out of the picture theater.
And then that kind of clicked. And then the gym guy, Jim Cunningham, who played the inspirational speaker, kind of took on a new role where he seemed to be viewed as like Satan, you know,
and taking
away people.
Gets up and calls him the Antichrist in front of the whole crowd.
Yeah, and when Donnie Darko calls him the Antichrist in the crowd, and then that's further implemented that he's Satan and bad and all that.
Yeah.
When Donnie Darko burns down his home and he finds that is discovered that he has a whole entire kiddie porn stash, which I found really well. When I finally discovered that sort of religious sort of symbolism throughout the whole entire film, the film actually started making a lot of sense to me, like if I could start putting these characters. And then you start kind of looking at all the other characters, like Drew Barrymore's character, the doctor that actually hands the book, the philosophy book of time to Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
They all kind of resemble like a sort of angel.
They're the angels on his shoulder.
All guiding him, to a... different to actually fulfill his destiny.
That's why I said, well, could the rabbit be God? He is the one thing throughout the whole film that's constantly appearing to Donnie and beckoning him forward into the future towards his destiny, even though he has no idea really what he's doing. And he's the only authority that you notice that Donnie actually answers to in the entire movie. And this is something I kind of picked up on, a point that I want to make, is that in a way you could say this is a coming-of-age movie because it's really about Donnie railing against all authority in his life.
Yeah.
You know, his parents want him to take the pills and be normal,
well,
and he doesn't want to do that.
Pills themselves are a symbol of control, you know, that he has to break free of, you know. So, and there's Frank trying to pull him away from that control and let him do his crazy, which also turns like the idea of good and evil on his head, because some of the things that Donnie Darko does in this movie are quite... well, they're psychotic, really, like how he actually floods the school and that, you know, stabbing the mirror with the knife and all that, and even shoots someone at the end.
Yeah.
If you take the whole entire time travel, make that irrelevant out of the film, you're dealing with a seriously disturbed child here, you know. That really needs help, so...
I mean, you could say perhaps it ends, you know, with that good old, oh, it was all just a dream, he's actually just in a... padded cell somewhere.
Well, they kind of did that, though, that up. In a way. Like,
but I kind of don't like saying that about movies because it feels like a bit of a cop-out, really.
It does, but in a way, like, Donnie Darko kind of subverts that cop-out that we don't like where it's all a dream, because the film, in a way, is like...
because it's set up in such a way to make you question about whether it really matters much. Yeah.
Well, like, and none of that ever happened. That could have just been, like, an interpretation... of his death, again, if you take away that time-travelling sort of idea from it. But the film really, it's almost like an experiment in, like, the bootstrap, you know, time-travel paradox a bit. Like, you know, the idea you were talking about just before we start recording this where you go back in time and you shoot your grandfather, but you needed your grandfather to actually exist, you know?
Yeah, the classic kind of time paradox.
Because I talked about this with Roberta Sparrow, Grandma Death, the character in that.
Yeah.
And I kind of, halfway through that movie, I was trying to develop a theory in my own head that maybe she was like part of like a broken part of a bootstrap paradox, and that's why she's kind of repeating.
That's why she's always walking back from the mailbox back home to the mailbox again. She's caught in this constant time loop. In her mind.
Yeah, in her mind, you know, something like that. On those.
And that was one of the themes that I came to you with first thing today was you know, I think that the movie is really subverting the traditional time travel narrative by making the concept of time be very kind of contingent upon the continuity of consciousness.
You also made another interesting, because the movie deals with this idea of free will and determinism, like everything is already, and you can't really change that at all. And just talk about how subverting time travel sort of stories in that. You said to me that this is more a film where time actually chooses the hero.
Yeah.
You know, not the hero chooses the time. So.
Yeah, yeah. I did say that. And I just got to direct my thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. It's all right. It's Tony Darko. We all get a headache from it. So.
Yeah, but what was. Because Donnie, like he, well, like you were saying before about free will, is he wants to have agency. He's constantly trying to gain agency for himself because he's trying to escape his fear. And his fear of dying alone, which is his big thing. And he wants to be able to control his life, but through the whole movie, he doesn't really have much, any agency. Until the very end, when he's presented with the choice to either survive in his alternate timeline or go back, die, and then die for everyone else's sin, like a good Jesus character would.
The other thing that just popped into my head then too, like the movie also, the idea of a vessel, right? The movie tries to throw it over your head that you need a vessel, you know, to travel through time. And then I just popped in my head there, so I'm kind of clutching at straws here, but is philosophy, like the movie even seems to ask, like philosophy, questioning things is the way to actually travel through time?
Yeah.
In a way, like even down to the book, the philosophy of time
philosophy
travel.
It's not time
about
travel.
Time travel, it's the philosophy of time travel, you know, so.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, could you project your conscious being through time? And I think can consciousness... Can you manipulate time and our continuity with consciousness? Because we see ourselves, you know, existing independent of time in a way. But, you know, our decisions, you know, it's the choices we make with our heads influence the flow of time and how, you know, how the physical world pans out. So if you put that into a time travel kind of scenario, you are kind of bending reality with your mind.
Yeah.
Because your conscious thoughts are influencing the physical world. I made this example earlier to you today. Sorry. I made this example to you earlier today.
Yep.
Where, you know, you've got a file saved, a draft essay saved on your USB card, and you transfer that to the computer.
Yep.
You finish the essay on the computer, then you put it back on to the USB card. You can either overwrite the file, the original file on the computer, or you can rename it and create a separate file that is an evolution of the original one, but it's a separate file.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you were to look at time travel... a similar way, you know, what if I were to teleport myself back to 5 minutes ago, replace, you know, just delete the original version of me 5 minutes ago and replace it with the current one?
Yeah.
And then all I've really changed there is my consciousness, because I'm now, I have a prophecy, I'm aware of something I'm going to do in the future, and therefore I have the power to alter that shit decision.
Because this is where the movie gets quite fascinating too, because it does offer that explanation of two, like it does play around with the thought. I wouldn't say that actually directly actually expresses the thought, but it does play around with the idea that there could be two Donnie Darkos, you know, in two universes that need to sort of come together.
That it's an alternate time stream.
Because we also, I think you didn't click onto it until I mentioned it, but with the idea of, like, Halloween, you know, being the planes where, you know, death and life actually meets. And at first we just thought it was just a convenient way, you know.
Yeah, All Hallows Eve.
But I don't think that would have actually been Richard Kelly's intent, though, to just chuck in Halloween on
just for the sake
on the end of
having
the world.
A Halloween party in
that
American
just seems
movie.
A bit
yeah.
too like much of a consequence. So I really do think there's actually.
I'm really glad you did point that out, Ashley.
Cause, yeah, because that makes sense because it plays directly into the idea of trying to bridge that gap of like these two parallel worlds.
Yeah.
Coming together and uniting them as one. You know.
Yeah, because well, All Hallows Eve. In the pagan tradition was a time where, basically the world as we know it and the spiritual realm would merge. It was where the barrier between the two would get quite thin. It was considered to be a time of great spiritual energy, which kind of got hijacked by the Judeo-Christian tradition and turned into Christmas.
Yeah, because once that actually happens...
Oh, sorry, you turned into Halloween.
Because once Halloween actually happens, and that's where the time portal actually happens, and then they need the vessel, but they need the philosophy of time travel. Because I think the film also kind of tricks you a bit. It plays around with the idea of the aeroplane being the actual vessel, but that's not the actual vessel that actually travels. It's the actual thought of time travel that actually changes the actual trajectory of the actual timeline that happens in the first place that actually sends through the airplane jet through the wormhole.
And that's what I was trying to say before about consciousness altering reality is it's Donnie Darko's thought that really sets him off on this completely different tangent and kind of creates this, this pocket dimension. Yeah.
Because the film, like in most of hero stories, because this is a basic hero story journey, usually at the end of a movie where they're going to resolve the issues, they pull out like a sword, you know, from a stone, or they do like a big fireball from their hand or whatever. Yeah. This doesn't do this. It just has Donnie Darko reflecting on the same hill where it started at the beginning of the movie where he woke up.
Yeah.
So that's what the actual weapon... Like, he's not there to punch the sky or anything. He's just there to think about it.
He's just there to look at it, yeah.
And again, like, the narrative of the story, like, it just gives you enough information, just cuts right at the point where you're actually going to find out what's actually going on, just leaving the viewer clueless as to what's going on.
But that's what this movie really does, and I think it does it well. Is just leave it completely ambiguous at the end. It sets up all these kind of threads and it gives you some hints about what direction it could be going, what it could mean, but then really just leaves it and leaves you to think about it. And that's one of the things I loved it. I loved about it, and I think it's one of the things that a lot of people understandably didn't like about it was because it leaves you without that kind of sense of closure.
Yeah. Well, it does leave you closure or it doesn't?
It doesn't, in a way.
It doesn't, no. Like, because Donnie's dead at the beginning and all that.
But it does for Donnie.
Because it's his story.
It's his story, and the final scene is really him finally getting closure from his entire life of kind of struggle.
Yeah.
Against his own mind, basically.
In a way, it even sounds like, you know, like it was suicide in a way, come to think of it, because he was like sacrificing himself so he'd just clear off all these thoughts. Because they constantly go talk about throughout the whole entire film, if you could change anything in the past, why would you do that, you know, to make everything happy again?
Yeah.
And back to this idea of Donnie Darko being a, you know, crazy, you know, mentally disturbed child or whatever, you know, like for him, because it's his story, it would make sense that suicide would be the way of actually fixing all the problems again.
Well, in his struggle, as I was saying before, he's railing against authority, trying to find the meaning in his life. He sets up, you know, all these, you know, this kind of domino effect that leads to these terrible events happening. Leads to Gretchen being killed and so forth. And the only way he can fix it is by cancelling himself out, by deleting the corrupt copy. You know.
Yeah. I just wanted to touch on a few other things that I found sort of interesting. So we covered the bootleg. One thing I've always loved, and the reason why I loved the film originally was because of that one scene where Donnie Darko cracks it, you know, like Fear and Love, and he gets given like a card, which is a direct reference to the book that was referred in the first scene where we first meet the teacher about the Destructors by Graham Greene. Mm. And it's the same problem again that he's been given. And he's now being told to simplify the story where before he was told to give a complicated explanation.
Yeah.
So in the past room, he was praised for giving a complicated explanation, but in this room, complexity is actually frowned upon by his teacher, who's
yeah.
rather naive and stuff. You know, ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, he's been kind of told to, you know, sit down and roll over.
Mm.
You know, and he feels completely out of control of himself.
Yeah, did you find any other themes in there that you think need exploring? Because Fear and Love is a big one, and I think that's another motif. It's not just about the mind and the outside world and the paradox and all that, but it also deals with, like, so religion's another one, free will, philosophy. But I sort of like the inspirational speaker, how the inspirational speaker is portrayed as, like, the bad character in that movie. Like, he is the... Well, if you're looking at it from a narrative point of view from Donnie Darko, he is the official bad guy.
Yeah.
And that teacher that absolutely praises him, I can't remember her name, but she is like one of his demons type of thing. But she's also ignorant to the fact that she's also being bad. So
And his character is really set up, I think, to be a sort of, you know, to propel Donnie through the narrative.
Mm.
And he is the embodiment of everything that Donnie really hates about the culture he has grown up in. This complacency and this simplistic black and white way of looking at the world that categorizes everything into these two bipolar extremes that he's completely enslaved to. And what makes him what was his name again?
Jim Cunningham.
Jim Cunningham, yeah. Yep. What makes him a poor person and a really bad character is because he's weak.
Mm.
And because, you know, despite all his talk of, you know, going the path of...
Yeah, righteousness. The
path of love over and denying fear, he is the most fearful person in that whole story. Mm. You know, there's that scene at the end when Donnie dies and, you know, you just see him getting up in his bed, you know, waking up having a bad dream and just crying.
Mm.
And he's spending his whole life trying to escape his fear.
Mm.
And what he's really most scared of is himself and his own, these drives, you know, because he's a pedophile, these drives within him that he can't escape.
One thing I also liked was this idea of everyone was a prisoner of fear. And even Donnie Darko himself was a prisoner of fear. You know, it wasn't until he actually broke free of his fear of...
Well, it was all the people who really tried to... They're trying to escape fear the most, away from it, who actually class fear as the enemy, are the ones who are the most fearful and the most, weak in their lives.
And it wasn't until Donnie Darko kind of, had to face his fear that he actually was able to reset the whole entire timeline again
and
put everything back on.
He had to face his fear of dying alone.
Mm.
And, I wrote this down on my notes for some reason, but, you know, perhaps the kind of message there is that the moment we face death is the moment when we're most truly alive.
Yeah.
Because when we're no longer caught between this, kind of carrot and stick, always running away from something and trying to achieve some ideal and actually living in the present.
I'm trying to find something else that we haven't even... I did just write down a few parts of the movie that I really, really liked. I think this begs who was the guy smoking a cigarette watching Donnie Darko?
Yeah, who was the fat man?
Who was the fat man? What was his shtick? He appeared twice in the movie.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
One thing I wasn't too certain about in the movie, actually, was that Asian girl who used to get picked on for being overweight and Asian throughout the whole entire film. And I don't know, you made a good observation, like she was kind of playing like...
That,
Donnie Darko was like a Jesus Christ figure.
Yeah, she represents the herd.
Herd. Yeah, down to even praising Donnie Darko, where she drops down a diary, you know, with "I love Donnie Darko" all over it. So,
There's always a passage in the Bible, isn't it? You know, you shall shepherd the weak and the blind and the sick. And I think she kind of represented that, you know, because she's completely clueless.
Mm.
She's just the observer. She's there, seeing all this happen.
Mm.
And what I found really interesting was that moment when Donnie Darko finally walks up to her and looks her in the eye and says, "Everything's going to be all right for you." That terrifies her and she runs away.
But Harris does say it in like a Jesus Christ sort of way, like, "Everything's going to be all right, you know, yay, my saviour." I was trying to also figure out throughout the whole entire film was Donnie Darko's little sister, and she was carrying around the unicorn throughout the whole entire film. And instantly, someone like me loves unicorns, you know. But I actually think, like, the unicorn was meant...
Rowan is a brony.
I think that the movie was actually trying to say something along the lines, like, use the motif of the unicorn as a way of, like, the unicorn being free, you know, like...
Yeah.
But I think the film didn't go too far until because of editing reasons. Well,
we kind of decided that the unicorn was freedom. The symbol of freedom. And it was just it's a completely elusive thing that it just kind of appears. I kind of thought because, you know, the child was always carrying, it could just be, you know, sort of symbol of, like, innocence, really, and complete unawareness of the world.
Or
it could have just been a unicorn. Because unicorns are fun to have in movies, people.
It's usually a young girl that has a big fluffy unicorn. So,
we must find a unicorn in everything.
I also found it interesting where he goes into Jim Cunningham's place and he's burning down everything. He's burning down the actual idol of everything. And I found out what the name of the movie was. It was The Temptation of Christ.
Yeah, and that's where I said, you know, he's burning the false idols.
So, and especially where Frank appears in that as like a, almost like a godlike figure, and not how he actually would interpret God, which is bizarre. But do you think, I've never watched The Temptation of Christ, but do you think Donnie Darko was actually tempted? Well, like, he had one last temptation. What was his last temptation, if there was one? Was there any sort of symbolism with the actual movie, The Last Temptation of Christ?
The Last Temptation of Christ. Perhaps, I don't know, Gretchen was his last temptation.
Possibly. It's a bit of a tough one. Then again, that to me even seems like a thing, like, if Richard Kelly was playing on the narrative of religious symbolism and that, maybe that was just there to sort of just sort of hone in.
Yeah.
Like,
I think it would have been there to kind of over
because he wasn't watching The Last Temptation of Christ. I can't see young teenage students in that era going to watch The Temptation of Christ unless they were a bit messed up in the head.
Kind of interesting that Gresham and Donnie were the only two people in that theatre.
Well, there was another movie playing. I didn't get the name of the other movie that was playing, but it looked like just a normal horror flick that, you know, people go take their first dates on. So, so did you actually get the date? Did you actually get the time of, like, how long the Earth, you know, the apocalypse? Did you write that down?
Wait, it was... 28 days, 6 hours, 42 minutes, and 12 seconds.
Man, I wish... Does that even line up? I actually all the numbers in there. So, there's no 7, is there, in there? No.
Well, perhaps I got it wrong. You had it written down on there.
Possibly. Hang on. You just talk for a minute. Okay, grab it.
talking.
So how long did he have? 28 days, 6 hours, 42 minutes and 12 seconds.
12 seconds.
Were you correct?
Yep, so I did write that down. Woo!
What else is there? Can you...
I think that's probably just a number that they just pulled out of their ass.
Oh, I think so. If that had significance, I'd be like, well, Richard Kelly, you sly dog. So, you're crazy, Richard Kelly. You're crazy, man. You're just out there just...
Maybe it's like, if you're reading to it enough, it's an Illuminati confirmed moment.
So, all in all, would you have a philosophical rating for Donnie Darko? Does it make you think? How many Platos would you give it out of 5?
I would easily give it four Platos out of 5.
Four Platos out of 5? Yeah, you know what? I think as a movie that makes you think, makes you question everything, it gets a 5 out of 5. Yeah. 5 Platos.
Four Platos, maybe 3.5 Socrates out of 5 Socrates.
We'll develop a rating. But does the rating system actually mean anything? So
no, it's completely arbitrary. That's the whole point.
It's completely arbitrary. You don't need a rating system. Don't listen to Rotten Tomatoes. Go have some free will. Well, I just like the sort of...
value is subjective.
I'd sort of like to end up on this podcast by saying Donnie Darko, it's a film that if you like philosophy, if you like thinking, you will love Donnie Darko. It's just begging for that. It just wants you to dissect the heck out of it. You
probably won't come to any particularly constructive conclusions about anything in this movie.
But it's a fun movie to talk about. You know? Yeah. I put it on there, even up there with Star Wars. Like, another fan of Donnie Darko, I can go up to him and I can just sit there and just talk about how good of a movie it is.
I feel like one day I should definitely go out and actually just write an essay.
Go into Jock's Cave.
You get structured with this and actually make a kind of analysis of it.
Yeah.
With some kind of cohesion.
Cohesion? Yeah. Well, this is a podcast. Cohesion doesn't exist here, boy. So. What do you think this is?
You can't handle the truth.
You have any final thoughts on Donnie Darko?
Good movie.
Good movie. Yes. Go see it. If you haven't seen it and you listen to this podcast, what type of crazy fool are you? Should we end it there?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. As we ended off today, I would like to say to anyone that's listened to us, please subscribe to the Pop Philosophy Facebook page. Please subscribe to the iTunes channel and please subscribe to any other mediums. Hopefully we can get this on Stitcher. And any other place where you like to listen to podcasts. Thank you. I am Rowan Cook.
And I'm Jock Gray.
And we need a tagline. Do you have a tagline?
Not yet.
Not yet. We'll come up with a tagline next week.
We're going to work hard
on that. We're going to work hard. Okay, thank you.
All right, see ya. Bye.